And let me play among the stars. Let me know what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, darling, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing. I long for all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Wednesday edition. Today's date is the 24th of October, 2007. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you here with me for an installment of the French Connection. We are, for the second day, using our new phone line here. And we're very excited because hoping that the quality of our broadcast is already going to start getting better. We are using landlines, so no longer are we having to put up with the inconsistency of Skype. But also, we're calling England, and we're calling a cell phone, and we're hoping that the cell phone quality stays up. So please bear with us during this recording, and hopefully you'll enjoy the quality as opposed to what it's been. Again, it's great to have my guest here today. His name is, of course, Andrew Hitchcock, Andrew Carrington Hitchcock. He wrote a book that we have been promoting from the beginning. It's called The Synagogue of Satan. Andy, as you will know, started out collecting information, and it turned into a book. It was so extensive, the amount of information available, that he found about the conspiracy all of us know so well. And I have to say that some of the information in this book is just stomach-turning. But when you start looking at the names of the people involved around this conspiracy, they are the who's who of both Europe and America's political elite. And we're going to do another 30-page installment today as part of our ongoing series with Andrew, and we couldn't be happier to do that. Andrew, are you with me?
Yes, Daryl. Very nice to be back on the show again.
It's wonderful to have you back, Andrew. You know, as usual, this is the battle here. This is the information, the truth, the facts, as we can find them, and we want to put them out in front of everybody. We're going to start today with the year 1998, and it's for people who already have the book. It's page 241 if you'd like to follow along with some of our comments. But here's the interesting thing that I'd like to start with, because you go into the rather sordid vulgarity of Israel in the beginning of this segment. The fact that people in Israel have had a long history of sex slavery and prostitution and importing of large numbers of women prostitutes to Israel. But what I know as a fact also is that they're involved in this trade worldwide and have been involved with actually private mercenary companies to provide them with women. But in your book, what we started with in 1998, you have a thing here about the Tropicana in Tel Aviv in the business district, and it's it says it's one of the busiest bordellos or brothels in Israel. And you want to expand on what they've done here?
Yeah, well, what they've been doing is, funny enough, this article was actually was from an article written by Michael Spector, story in the New York Times on January 18th of that year. But what they've been doing is getting Slavic women, if you like, the East European women and what have you, that going to be quite attractive and what happens, and bringing them over to Israel under false pretenses and going to get jobs as secretaries and what have you. And when they get there, they find that they lose their papers and they get forced into prostitution. If they go to the police, then there's just no help for them. And this guy who wrote the article says that nearly all the prostitutes in Israel today are actually Russian or Eastern European from that area. Yeah. Their boss, however, is not. And it's just another example of really treating people like cattle, the goyim, as it were.
Yeah.
But I think the clear thing here is that this is something that's going on. I've read articles that you find the rabbis cycling down there and cycling back, and so it's all completely acceptable what they're doing. And they obviously prefer to have white women to do it to as opposed to their own.
Well, that's right. You move on from there and start talking about the PNAC, and I think this is an important thing to bring up here, because in 1998, Bill Clinton, he received a letter from a group called the Project for a New American Century, and here are the signatories, and I'm going to read them out, and then we're going to talk about it a little bit, but Elliot Abrams, Richard Armitage, William Bennett, Jeffrey Barringer, John Bolton, Paula Dobrzynski, Francis Fukuyama, Robert Kagan, Zalmay Calizard, William Crystal, Richard Pearl, Peter Rodman, Donald Rumsfeld, William Schneider, Vin Weber, Paul Wolfowitz, James Woolsey, and Robert Zulik. Now, here's the interesting thing. Everybody save two are Jewish. Everybody save two. Now, not just any Jew, and we have to make this clarification here, as I always do on this broadcast. They are a special brand of Ashkenazi Jew that we call Zionists. So they are Zionist Jews, ladies and gentlemen. Make no mistake about it. But this PNAC document is quite significant in the flow of this criminal group's activities, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. And the interesting thing with this is a document that's calling for an immediate military action against Iraq. Bear in mind, this is 1998 now. And then after that, in the document they say, in the long term, it means removing Saddam Hussein and his regime from power. That now needs to be the aim of American foreign policy. A lot of these people, as we know, are now in the Bush government, the so-called neocons.
Yep.
And what have we had? A war in Iraq, Saddam Hussein removed from power, everything that they wanted. And funny enough, in September in 1998, Bill Clinton was on a visit to Ireland, and in a speech, he actually said, you know, by the time you become leader of a country, someone else makes all the decisions. You may find you can get away with virtual presidents, virtual prime ministers, virtual anything. And that's a very interesting comment to make when you've got these groups behind the scenes, and it really goes to show. I'm never a fan of these politicians because they know exactly what's going on and they should be doing something about it. But every now and then they seem to think, oh, we'll sort of say something just to, you know, they walk over me, but I'll sort of fight back with a little bit here and a little bit there. But,
well,
of course...
Yeah, go ahead.
No, of course, it's just, you know, it's like sort of throwing a little rock against a steamroller, really.
Here's the interesting thing about the PNAC and then what it was purporting. They had already subjugated and crushed the Iraqi nation under sanctions, where we already had between 2 and 5 million deaths that were indirectly or directly related to the actions of both the British government and the American government on behalf of Zionists. And we had starved the children, we had starved the population, we had stopped the importation of equipment for their water system, their electric companies, everything. Now, I don't know if you know much about that region, but Iraq was considered a first-world country in its infrastructure, its school systems, in its highways and roadways and bridges. But in the 10 years, they reduced that place to less than third world, and... the PNAC came along after they had done most of the damage.
Well, yes, and I think that possibly the most disturbing thing I've ever seen on the internet is the deformed Iraqi babies and that were born. I'm sure you've seen those images. They're absolutely horrific. And the fact that these people can just go and do that sort of thing and just how on with it, just goes, and they have absolutely no conscience whatsoever.
Well, it's sociopathic, in my view, the inability to empathize with what the people from the country they're doing this to is sociopathic. It's sick, but I think the people doing this are brought up and fed a diet of supremacist, doctrine and dogma. Because how could a sentient human with any kind of feelings for his fellow man allow these kinds of activities to go on in a country? I remember doing interviews with, I don't know if you remember this, but I did an interview with Dennis Halliday.
Yeah.
And Dennis was there during the 90s when they were starving these kids. And this is a man with a conscience. And he said his whole job was trying to save children so they could be fed and you know, get diabetics, insulin, and things like this. He said finally he got so frustrated with the horrors he saw that he had to walk away from it. But even the United Nations was on board with these criminals. So what does that say about our world's governmental structures, even international structure, yeah?
Oh, absolutely. And, I mean, we well know now that these people are all controlled by this group. And they just set up these different organizations to try and give some sort of, you know, the United Nations is there to protect people, and of course it never does. It actually causes, it's used more for literally butchering people in the various countries that they've been into. But they use their media to try and illustrate that they're a wonderful organization, like, and they have offshoots like UNICEF, and you find that they've been involved in all these, you know, vaccination programs in Africa that have caused outbreaks of, you know, HIV has been put in there and all sorts of stuff. A big depopulation organization is what I consider the UN to be.
Yeah, the World Health Organization actually got caught distributing a vaccine for women that was laced with a Depo-Provera type of ingredient in it that made women sterile. And it wasn't until the vaccine was sent to India for testing that they discovered that this thing had been laced with it. And this was with the monies from Bill Gates. But let's go on here and talk a little bit about the IMF now. And what happened in the 98 period was that the Asian tigers, who had been so badly beaten by that implosion, which was orchestrated by Soros and the Rothschild banks, back in the 94 period, 1994-95, were now in being told that they could not support their poor with a feeding program. And you talk about that in Indonesia. Indonesia has been terribly abused as a country, has it not?
Oh, absolutely. They've essentially gone in there to get soak up the money out of Indonesia.
Yep.
They've also been into Brazil. They've been all over the region, as we know, Argentina and what have you. But the interesting thing, when they went into Brazil, they set out what was known as a master plan for Brazil. This is what the World Bank called it. Mm-hmm. And they had five requirements to ensure a flexible public sector workforce. And these were reduced salary and benefits. That was number one. Two, to reduce pensions. Three, to increase work hours. Four, to reduce job stability, and five, to reduce employment. So these people go into these countries, they lend them money that they know they can't repay, and then they go in and make all these demands that essentially mean the people have to suffer in order to pay the interest on the debt that they forced on the country.
Yeah.
And it's countries that don't want to borrow from the IMF and the World Bank are the countries that they go after as well, with military action and what have you, because they need all the countries in the world to be under their control.
Well,
and the way that they do it.
Yeah.
And they're always
We talked a little bit about this, Andrew, with Mohammed Rafiq, about how Malaysia actually didn't tell the IMF and World Bank to get out of Malaysia, but they found a way not to accept their money.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well,
and you see what they... You see what they say about, you know, Mahathir Mohamad, who was the Prime Minister, I believe, or President over there. and he gets absolutely rubbished in all the media about what a villain he is. And of course, we know the real reason why they don't like him. They wouldn't have any qualms about anybody with human rights abuses or anything like that, because they commit more human rights abuses than anybody. But their main aim is to get control of these people, and if they can't get control of them, they'll use their media, they use all the different tools at their disposal that they listed, if you like, in the protocols. And we just see it happening in so many areas of our world and so many areas of our culture.
Well, it's interesting you also included in this time frame the Amdocs information. And, of course, for listeners who are not aware of what Amdocs does, they are the billing company for all phone companies in America. So if you make a phone call to any place in the United States or internationally, the information is jotted down in the bill, and that billing company is 100% controlled by Israel. Now, this is a very frightening thing, because anytime they want to do a background sketch of any individual in the United States, they just have to look at their phone activity to find out exactly who they're associated with. You know, they don't necessarily need to listen to you right away to find out what it is and who you are speaking to. And since Amdocs has all this information, it's almost like they're even above the intelligence services with this kind of stuff.
Yes, and again, it's all about control. What they're trying to do is they want to know what everybody's doing so they can monitor different people. They'll use all these, one of their favourites is to get these very right-wing sort of shows, you know, the far right and the Nazi sort of side of things in the truth movement, if you like. You get a lot of these hosts out there like Hal Turner that are always encouraging people to do this, that and the other. And at the same time, these people will be logging on. They can be getting their details from when they log on the internet and all sorts of different things, email addresses, all these sort of things. And it's just another sort of arm to that, really. What they want is they know that they're going to get found out, and so they're trickling the information out slowly.
Yeah.
And so when they do get found out, they need to know who the danger men are and who the sort of, if you like, the sort of whack jobs, if you like, that some of them that are out there that literally, you know, literally want to go out and kill senators and what have you, because they've been essentially brainwashed into it by a lot of these programs. And that really is the idea behind it. I think that you've got all these prisons built in America. No one's in them. These big holding centres or what have you, and they've got to be there for a purpose. And I think that they're going to get to a stage where there'll be another attack of some sort, and then they'll decide to, this attack was by a sort of Timothy McVeigh character, so we've now extended the Patriot Act or whatever. I think the measures are already there, actually, where we can, you know, round up anybody that we consider could do a similar act, and then they'll get all these people that are already involved in it. And everybody else will be too scared to speak out. And it'll just be like it was in Russia, 85 years ago.
Well, I don't know. I think we're in a race here to wake people up faster than they can get that executed. And ultimately, I'm hoping that if that does come to pass, that people would pick up their weapons and be an aggressive force against that kind of thing. But we'll have to see, because actually these people prosper in violence. They prosper and they do their best to dirty work during times of anarchy. So it's kind of a tough call when it comes to that. However, you know, there is no other alternative if someone's going to come and drag you out of your home by the hair and put you in an internment camp. I can see no alternative but to fight back. However, you go on here to talk about George Bush having ties to the Jewish community, and I have looked at information that said there were Bushes that came over as New Bohemians. That's what they were described as in the period of 1760, 1750. One of them was a George Bush, and the other one was a Solomon, came over with packs of money, and they were involved in Freemasonry. Now, I don't know if that's the same Bush family that established this particular criminal group that George Bush and his father are, carrying forward. But where did you get the information he was actually a crypto Jew?
Well, I saw different documents. I think you had the there was that famous soldiers or those sailors book that listed some Bushes in there. Tex Mars did a lot of work on it that I looked at, which essentially traced. I mean, if you trace Bush back and then you go back to sort of into the Harrimans and what have you, you've certainly got the Rothschild link there. I believe that they go back to the Rothschild family. But essentially, the nature of their actions as well, in fronting for this group, I would suggest to people, if they want to read up on this further, if they go George Bush Zionist or George Bush Jewish and then put Tex Mars into their Google search engine, he's got a lot of information that he put out in a newsletter. We also have George Bush. A lot of people have seen the famous photo of him attending the Talmudic classes, the picture of him with the Talmud under his arm.
Some people claim that that was a Photoshop situation, but I don't know whether it is or it wasn't. What is your take on that?
Well, it came off a Jewish website, and they put photos. All their photos are of different famous people, if you like, mainly politicians who are together with rabbis or what have you, and they say, look, we've got, this is whoever with, I don't know, John Bolton or things like that. And this was one of those series of pictures, and it came out there, and I think that they then tried to backtrack and say, oh, we photoshopped that, but they didn't photoshop any of the others. It's the only one that they claim to have then photoshopped as a joke. But you just need to look at his actions, and, you know, he's kind of doing more for Israel than Ariel Sharon did. I mean, he's fighting all their wars for them and using all the American troops to do so.
Well, let's go on to this next subject here about the drug trade and the arrest of this guy named Orgad. Jacob Orgad, he was bringing in millions and millions and millions of pills of ecstasy to the United States. But what's striking about his story is that he was he's a Mossad agent, and you put former Mossad agent. I would be more inclined to call him an active Mossad agent who was just working in their drug field. But you want to expand on that a little?
Well, I mean, I would agree with you, Daryl. I mean, the pieces I saw about it referred to former, but I think it's like a lot of these CIA people. I don't think any of them very few of them have ever really left.
Yeah.
It's certainly my experience of, and I know you've had experiences with people that you've interviewed and you've later questioned. I think that Kathy O'Brien, Mark Phillips is one that strikes me. But, again, what we've got here is a drug ring, which is nothing surprising when you consider that these people were up in that with the China Opium Wars through the Sassoon branch of the Rothschild family there and getting all of China hooked on opium. But the interesting thing here is that they were using Hasidic Jews. So your Jews in your black hats and their black coats and the locks of hair dangling around their ears. And they were using them to smuggle the drugs in to America.
Yeah.
And the commissioner of the United States Customs Service, a guy called Raymond W. Kelly, stated the drug comes to us from various smuggling bases, mainly Europe, the Dominican Republic, and Canada. He goes on to say Israeli organized crime groups dominate the trade. And I think this also, it goes to the... when you've got this situation now, certainly we have it a lot in the UK with people in various religious dress, and, for example, you can't carry a knife in the UK, but a Sikh is allowed to carry a knife because that's part of his dress, and they have to have it as part of their religion. And again, here you'll have a Jew coming into the country, and it's going to worry the customs people as to, well, maybe don't search that guy because, you know, we could lose our job for discrimination against someone on the way that they dress, their religion, and what have you. And because the groups that they point out as being dangerous are Muslims and these sort of people, they'd be more, they'd feel that they have more backup, if you like, to search them. Mm-hmm. But they're not going to go and search these people because it's only ever said in the, never said in the mainstream media that these people are dangerous. In the mainstream media, these people are wonderful. They're the good guys over in the Middle East, and all the Arabs are the bad guys. So they, it just goes to show that it's another way that they've used what they've pushed to get away with things that other people wouldn't get away with.
Well, here's an interesting thing that I've actually talked a little bit about in the next subject here is the Rome Observer story about the pedophile crime gang that was actually killing children and filming it, raping them, killing them, and they were they had 1,700 customers that paid $20,000 to see 5-year-old children being brutally raped and killed. See, if you tell somebody something like this, the first impulse is you are crazy. Nobody would believe you if somebody had told me this 3 or 4 years ago, Andrew, I would have said, get out of town. This goes beyond anything rational. However, these people actually were caught, and the films were actually confiscated, and these people, this is unbelievable. You want to expand on this? This is awful. This is just awful.
Well, this is just one of the, another example of when I really have to question of the Jewish community. Too many of them stand with this group because they think, oh, Israel, that's us, and everyone's out to get us. And what we had here was when these people, this story was broadcast on the news and what have you in Italy, the elite Jewish community in Italy went mad. They were claiming blood libel, and they demanded that people who sat on the board of the TV network responsible, another Jewish group, would fire the news executives that allowed the story to broadcast. And so here what we've got is a story where the Italian police have broken up this paedophile ring. They've got the evidence. They've got 11 Jewish gangsters who are running it, and literally films of children being raped and killed at 5 years old, and all these elite Jews in Italy that spoke out about it are worried about, it's always showing us Jews in a bad light, even though they had all the evidence. So they don't care. They don't give a toss about the children or anything like that. They just want it all to be hushed up. And, of course, they got their way in America because none of America's news networks carried any report of this story.
Well, and not only that, they pushed another story like this out of Brussels with Mark Dutroux, who's also Jewish, and the people around his kidnap ring and all of the elites in Brussels were from the Jewish community. And now we've got this big ring over in Portugal coming to light, and I found two names from the Jewish community involved in that.
Well, there's a couple of interesting things there, Darrell. Firstly, when you were saying about the Portugal thing, you might have heard about this story that keeps going round in Britain about that Madeleine McCann, a girl that went missing.
Yep.
In Portugal with her parents on holiday. Now, they were both doctors, so they're obviously, mixed in high circles and what have you, and it does make you wonder if there was this sort of paedophile ring connection there, especially when we now know that a massive ring runs out of there. There's a lot of stories. I mean, the Portugal police basically believe that they killed their own daughter or did something with her, and that's what they believe, and they've tried to get her to admit to the mother to admit to it in interviews and stuff, and that's who they believed in it. And it's getting to a stage now where, because there's a lack of any other evidence, and they found DNA of her in a car that the parents hired after she was reported missing, so it was like they hid the body somewhere, retrieved it, and got rid of it. Anything could have happened. So we just have to wait and see how this one pans out. But the truth very rarely gets out in the mainstream media, as you know.
Well, we got the JonBenet Ramsey case where this little girl had some, and I mean, it looked very suspicious for the parents, too.
Oh, yes, exactly. And you know, a situation like that where they're dressing up these young girls to be really pretty and stuff like that. For these paedophiles out there, they must have an absolute field day. So I find it very surprising that these sort of beauty pageants for these, you know, toddlers, if you like, would not in any way be sort of infiltrated by this group. And it was probably something, an idea that was set up by this group. So I think there'll be different levels. They'll identify people that, you know, they know would be into this sort of thing, and they'll give them a bit of that first, and then if they do different things for them, then they'll get to have sex with different girls, and it'll just go on from there. But the other interesting thing he points out with Mark Dutroux is, I don't know if any of the listeners ever heard that he was Jewish. I certainly have never heard that he was Jewish off the mainstream media. I had to look it up myself, and then I found out that he was. And they'll say, Mark Dutroux, in Belgium. And they just won't mention that he's Jewish, because they don't want to, because they don't want to write anything bad about Jews. As far as they're concerned, they do all sorts of strange things. You had a film that came out that's been quite successful called Borat. I don't know if you've heard of that. And it's basically this guy who's Jewish, the actor in it, goes around in America pretending that he's from Kazakhstan and doing undercover filming, if you like, and just different things and seeing how people react. Now, one thing that he does is he goes to some bar and he performs this song, which is called Throw the Jew Down the Well. And all these people in the audience get drunk and they start joining in and what have you. And the idea of doing something like that is showing that, you know, how stupid these people are and how stupid this, you know, the role is, this guy from Kazakhstan, how stupid all these people are over there. And so any time that someone can think, oh, I've read something here and this, you know, this group, the neocons, they're Jewish, and these paedophile gangs are Jewish and all that. Oh, you're just like this guy from Kazakhstan, see, and throw the Jew down the well. You're mad. You're stupid. And that's, so they use all sorts of different methods to not only hide the fact of what they're up to, but they'll even use sort of so-called comedic films to give people the idea that questioning this sort of group just makes you look like an imbecile.
Well, and you know, one of the other ways they've promoted the silencing of the public is through this political correctness nonsense, where to have an opinion other than a mainstream opinion all of a sudden places you as some sort of evil possessor of someone who possesses evil knowledge or something. And of course, you know, we know that that started back in the late 1970s into the 80s. That became a very powerful tool for silencing any critics. And today, now, if you talk about ecology issues, or if you talk about racial issues, or if you talk, I remember as a kid, somebody was an African American. They were black. Okay. In the 1940s, they were Negroes. In the 1980s, they became black. And now, if you call someone black, that's pejorative. And now they have to be African Americans. But I don't know that calling anybody anything is the important thing. It's the attitude that goes along with what you call them. But see, that's not truth anymore. What they've done is they've made the words themselves bad. So at people, when you say the word Jew, people get all kinds of, oh my goodness, because what they've done is successfully turn that into a no-go area.
Oh, definitely. And this is, again, the whole idea behind it, because they always have to think a few steps ahead. And what you have to bear in mind is that when they push this issue, certainly in the UK, we don't want discrimination against homosexuals, we don't want discrimination against blacks or Asians or whatever, but they never actually say Jews. But of course, they fit into that category very well because they are a minority.
Yeah.
And so they push this diversity issue on, you know, sexual orientation and, you know, your main groups, if you like, of immigrants in the various countries, whether it's, blacks, Mexicans. In England, we have Indians, Pakistanis are a large group. They've never actually, because they put these laws and what have you into place, then again, they've just scuttled under the back door. So they can now say, anti-Semitic and all that, but it never actually said, if they were going to say, for example, include Jews in that group, where they were sort of promoting it, then people might ask questions, oh, why would they say that? Because, you know, with these different groups, I mean, some people are not going to like homosexuals for, I don't know, religious beliefs that they may have.
That's right.
Some people are not going to, they're going to look at crime figures, and unfortunately, crime figures do indicate that minorities can be responsible for a lot of the crime. Now, that could poverty issue.
Well, but how about this, Andrew? Instead of looking at the racial makeup of crime, how about looking at the income makeup of it?
That was just what I was going to say. I said they could identify that, but then you look at the income level, you look at the poverty level, and does it come out of the poverty level? But you see, with the Jewish level, they've always sort of been able to be, you know, either upper middle type class in these different areas, and so they've never had any sort of direct hatred, if you like, in recent years drawn to them.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, after World War II and that, because the way that panned out and the constant barrage that we get out of that, that's another thing that's protected them. So what I'm saying is that I'm certainly not saying that minorities are responsible for crime, don't get me wrong. I'm just saying that how people interpret certain things, it's very easy to simplify it and not look into it in detail. And they've used that mentality of people to get these sort of laws through.
Well, you know, one of the things that, now I don't have a problem with people's orientation sexually very much, but one of the things that is true about gay men in much of the world is that they have a tendency to have more than just multiple partners, in many instances, dozens a month in some instances. And what we have here is this bathhouse culture out of the gay community that has upwards of 200 and plus sex partners in a year. Now, that is considered by anybody's measure to be dangerous, not only dangerous from a public health standpoint, but also dangerous from a socially moral standpoint. And if a woman was doing that kind of thing, she would be labeled a nymphomaniac, and then of course maybe referred to mental counseling or emotional counseling. But see, to say this about the gay community in Canada now is a crime. And well, it's because what they've done is they've criminalized your ability to even make comments about social groups that, or the behavior of groups, because political correctness has completely stifled the debate in morality.
Well, yes, and I totally agree with you. And again, I mean, the people that tend to criticize these groups are, I would say, ardent, but whether it's the Bible or the Quran or what have you, they're followers of that, and of course that does criticize homosexuality in it, and they see their job as not saying to these people how bad they are, they're trying to turn them from it so they can save them. Now that's an opinion that they have based upon their belief, but they're not harming these people by going to these gay parades and giving their point of view. They're not throwing bottles at them or things like that. They're merely trying to say that they consider it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And these people are getting jailed for saying that. And so you can imagine how people are thinking that are, you know, very religious people. On top of that, you see, the other thing that they've done with all this promotion of gay bishops and what have you is they've made the church into really a bit of a farce.
Yeah.
Because the idea is that, you know, from my standpoint, I'm kind of have a similar view to you. It's not something that really bothers me. If people want to do what they want to do, that's up to them. But in that sexuality aspect, anyway. But as far as it goes with when you've got a so-called bishop who's high up in the church and he's supposed to strictly follow the Bible, if the Bible says that homosexuality is forbidden, and I think it goes into a far greater extent than that. But if it was to say that, then why on earth is he a bishop in a church?
Yeah.
Because you either it's not a book that you can take bits that you like out of and, you know, leave the bits that you don't like. You have to follow the whole book.
Yeah.
And by being in that position, you have to, A, follow the whole book, and B, be competent enough to instruct the vicars or priests or pastors below you to instruct their congregation also. So when you've got a situation like that, and then the media will say, oh, what's wrong with this? There's no problem with this. But it undermines their whole message. Do you see what I mean?
Well, that was by intent.
Oh, absolutely,
That's right. Well, look what they did with the Pope. I mean, they left this, the figurehead of the Catholic Church, a man who had to have a dribble cup hooked to his lip and drive him around mumbling it in speeches. And it was an embarrassment, but that was by design. There was absolutely no doubt in my mind that the Zionists have control over the Vatican, and they did that whole setup with this Pope being, completely... it was painful to see him. He looked like he belonged in an old folks' home, being fed by nurses, and here they are holding him up as the patriarch of the Catholic religion. That was done by design, and but let's move on anyway. I mean, that's a whole other file we could do on that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the two countries of Tanzania and Bolivia as a group here. The Third World is definitely not immune from attack by these people, and in most instances I've discovered that what they're trying to do is destroy any national cohesion in these Third World nations so that their businesses can go down and rape the natural resources, much like they have done for 100 years in South Africa. And you'll notice that both places, Bolivia and Tanzania, are full of resources, both oil and precious metals and bauxites and aluminiums. And my point being that the killing off of these populations and the destruction of any political cohesion in those countries serves them as a so that they can go in and rape these countries financially.
Well, yes. I mean, in Tanzania, where we've got about 1.3 million people dying of AIDS as of 2001, the World Bank and the IMF, because they'd loaned all this money, and the other way that they do it is as they always do with their bribery of politicians, you'll always find in these countries that some dictator or whatever, or even if he was an elected prime minister, will always seem to have disappeared with an amount of money. And of course, so he gets his kickback, so he's not too bothered. They know how easy it is to corrupt people, and for what they have to give that person, for the money that they'll make out of it, it's absolutely small potatoes. But the things that they were doing over there, they wanted to require Tanzania to charge for what were previously free hospital appointments. And when you've got a situation with all these people dying of AIDS, you know, hospital treatment is something that they're going to need. They also wanted Tanzania to charge school fees for their previously free education system. And then tried to act all surprised when the school enrollments dropped from 80% down to 66. And funnily enough, since the IMF and World Bank had been given the foothold in the Tanzanian economy, the gross domestic product dropped from $309 to $210 per capita. Literacy has fallen, poverty has risen, and now covers 51% of the population. And in June 2000, the World Bank said about Tanzania, because when they got in there was a socialist government, and, you know, the education and the healthcare was provided free. And they stated, one legacy of socialism is that most people continue to believe the state has a fundamental role in promoting development and providing social services. So basically what they're saying is, you live out here, you've been born out here, you've paid taxes out here, but we've raped the country, and so you don't get any healthcare or school or education for your children.
Yeah.
And so long as we get our money, and that's basically their attitude. Bolivia, it was what you've talked about a lot, Darryl, when they get hold of the water supply.
Yeah.
It's one of their favourites at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
But they drastically increased the price of water, which resulted in riots. And as they've done this over here as well, they so-called privatise the water supply, like they privatise everything because these companies that had it before, they weren't very good and what have you. And then you find out that all the infrastructure starts crumbling and because they don't invest in it. And so when the infrastructure starts crumbling, they say, oh, we need to charge more money, and we can only charge so much, so the government will have to pay some, because it's not our fault that we took over this and the infrastructure need replacing. So private companies are literally getting taxpayers' money to make profit. And this is what they've done over here as well. And we even had a company where I was living previously, near the south coast of England, and there was a water supply, Wessex Water, which was a privatised company, and it was actually owned by Enron. And the same with that, the quality dropped, the prices exploded, hose pipe bans, or we've got a water shortage, this, that, or the other. And the very interesting thing about when they privatise things like rail systems, water systems, another thing they say is, oh, because of competition, if we can get competition. But then you find that there is no competition. If you go to a station, then that station is part of a network.